starting off here with an image of Nyx, who's the Greek goddess of the night. And the title itself is going to be a bit of a mystery. So, and I do swear that I will be talking about what the organizers did ask me to talk about. So the other title that I could have used was Mapping the Local Dark Matter Halo with the Gaia Satellite. So the challenge here is going to be over the course of the talk to see why these two titles are actually going to be equivalent to each other. We have a picture of a dark matter halo around our Milky Way galaxy. This picture is founded on the idea that we see flat rotation curves in the Milky Way, which indicates that there's a lot more missing matter there than what we can actually observe. And I think we've probably all seen kind of images or sketches of a halo as kind of this big spherical blob surrounding our small little visible part of the galaxy. And what I want to talk about is how we can move from these simple caricatures of what the Milky Way halo looks like to something that's essentially an empirically motivated map of that dark matter halo. And with the data that we're getting from Gaia, that step is becoming a reality. So something that we can actually do in starting now and also in the upcoming years. So that's the story that I'm hoping to describe in a bit more detail over the course of the talk. I should say, please feel free to interrupt me at any point to ask any questions. So the underlying motivation for this is trying to understand what the dark matter distribution is in the Milky Way, and specifically pretty close to where the solar position is. The reason why we want to be able to characterize the dark matter this locally is because we have a host of direct detection experiments on Earth that are looking for dark matter. Looking specifically for a dark matter particle that flies in and scatters off some target in a detector, creating an observable signal. And for any of these kinds of experiments, the rate for that interaction is going to depend on the phase-based distribution of the local dark matter, so both its local density as well as its velocity distribution. So any prediction for these experiments, or also any interpretation of the results, depends on what this dark matter map is near our own little neighborhood in the galaxy. So there's a standard model that's been in place since the 1970s and 1980s for how we characterize the dark matter halo in the Milky Way. And we can think of this as a toy model. It's gotten us very far over the last few decades. The basic premise is as follows. So we assume that the dark matter is a collisionless fluid with some phase-based distribution that I've labeled here as F. If you then assume that the fluid mass is conserved, that the fluid is in steady state, that it has isotropic velocities, and that it can reproduce a flat rotation curve, which is essentially the observable we have to work with, then what sort of falls out of that is the fact that the number density for the dark matter is isothermal, so it goes as 1 over r squared, and its velocity distribution is just a simple Maxwell-Boltzmann. So whenever you see any result from a direct detection experiment, it's always assuming this model. This is essentially kind of the standard baseline that's used in the field. So what we have the opportunity to do now with the incoming data is to essentially reassess whether or not these are the correct assumptions that we should be putting into this model. So is the dark matter actually isotropic? Is it actually in steady state? So I think the steady state question is an interesting one, because we have to ask ourselves, what does it actually mean for our galaxy to be in steady state? So the picture we have in lambda cold dark matter is that our galaxy is built up from the mergers of lots of smaller galaxies. So we can think of the history of our galaxy in terms of its family tree. So we have sets of mergers where our galaxy early on may have merged with some other smaller galaxy growing in size. So it essentially accretes all of the dark matter and stars from that smaller merger. So in the scenario where we have a family tree that looks like this, where some merger happened a very long time ago, then the system, after this collision occurred, has enough time to reach steady state, giving us the galaxy that we have and live in today. So in this particular case, where the history is pretty quiet, the assumptions that go into the standard model for the dark matter, the assumption of steady state, is probably a good one. But we can contrast this with the alternative possibility where this merger history is really active, so where there's a lot of different mergers that are occurring over a long period of time, and that the system doesn't really have a chance to come into steady state. And in this particular sort of extreme limit of this case, the model that I showed you on the previous slide would break, because the steady state assumption would no longer hold. So the question is, which of these two is actually the correct version for our galaxy? And in order to know that, we need to actually infer something about the history of how our galaxy formed. So mapping the dark matter halo is going to be integrally related with inferring the history of the Milky Way galaxy and how it grew over time. So over the course of the talk, what I want to present is first a theory understanding using simulations for how we expect dark matter and stars to act as a galaxy builds up. Once we have that theory foundation, then we can start turning to data and ask what we can learn from information that's coming in from Gaia. And in the last part of the talk, I'll present some recent results from this summer showing how we've been using machine learning in this whole story. But let's just start off with this theory foundation. And I'll be discussing some work that's been led by an excellent postdoc at Caltech, Lina Nasib. So we've been working in collaboration with Phil Hopkins' group at Caltech, and they run simulations, hydrodynamic simulations of galaxies like the Milky Way. So the simulations are referred, these simulations are FIRE, so it stands for Feedback in Realistic Environments. These are high resolution simulations that track stars, gas, and dark matter starting from early redshifts going up until the present day. So they're really the state of the art in terms of what we have to work with in terms of understanding how galaxies like the Milky Way evolve. So Phil's group has a whole host of these simulations. They have numerous different Milky Way-like galaxies. I'll show you a movie now from one of these galaxies. So this is showing stars. It's not showing any dark matter. This is a galaxy that ends up with a mass that's very similar to the Milky Way. And what you see is how the galaxy has evolved, starting from redshifts, I think, of about 10 up until redshift 0. So I'll run the simulation again. So here, at the initial point, there's essentially nothing there, but you have these small clumps. So these are small galaxies that come in, get pulled in, and totally disrupted near the center. And with time, the galaxy grows, and you see that a disk forms, and the system sort of stabilizes, and then this is what we have today. So what the utility of these kinds of simulations is that we actually have truth information, because we know where the dark matter is, and we also know how the stars and the gas are behaving. So we can use these to test hypotheses about how dark matter and stars in galaxies like the Milky Way act and evolve as a function of time. So
one question. Should
yes.
You take the stars as point-like particles and the gas as a fluid? How do you describe this evolution?
You mean in the actual simulation? Okay, yeah. So that's a good question. So the stars are not point-like particles. So they're actually, and this is just set by the resolution of the simulation, they're essentially clusters, because they've got some mass. I think in this particular galaxy, it's like
clusters.
No, they're like a 10, I think in this case it was like 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 solar mass clump of stars. Mm-hmm. And similarly, the dark matter particles in the simulation are something like on the same order of magnitude, 10 to 4, 10 to 5 solar masses. So the simulation tracks the scattering, essentially the interactions, the gravitational interactions between these clumps. And then in addition,
they have no internal degrees of freedom.
That's correct.
So therefore they are
like, so it's like pieces of
Yeah.
Sort of like point like, except that they are extended due to force resolution.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Importantly, the simulation does keep track of feedback mechanisms. So there's like, for example, if a supernova explodes, it's going to inject some amount of energy and also change the chemical composition of the local gas near the supernova explosion. And so the simulation keeps track of those feedback mechanisms. So what I want to do now is essentially kind of take one of these simulated galaxies and just dissect it into bits. So starting from very early on, so in these kind of initial stages here, to the point where the disk has formed. And at each of these intervals of time, look to see specifically what's happening to the dark matter and stars that come in. So let's start in the very, very early times, so when essentially the proto-Milky Way is still forming, so where you're going from essentially nothing being there. I think I've lost this. Where's the stick?
It's on that cord.
Oh, okay, good. So where you go from
there being essentially nothing
here to, you know, starting to form something, but it hasn't quite gotten to the point where you have a stellar disk. So in these initial stages, when you have these collisions of smaller galaxies that get eaten up, you're redistributing the energy of the dark matter and the stars quite dramatically. And that mixes them in phase space. So as you're changing the gravitational potential of the system with each of these new mergers, you're also redistributing the energy of all of the gas and the dark matter that's there. What we can do is select all of the dark matter and the stars that came in the very, very early stages of this simulated galaxy, and then look to see how they're behaving today at z equals zero. So when we do that, and here's a plot of this just in terms of individual coordinates in velocity space, these are the dark matter and the stars that came in to this simulated galaxy at very, very early redshifts before redshift 3. And the dark matter is shown in black, and the stars are shown in red. These are their velocities today at z equals zero. And there's two things that kind of stand out from this. The first is that the velocity distributions are pretty boring, so they're all Gaussian. That's what you would expect for things that have come into equilibrium and have reached steady state. And additionally, the distributions land on top of each other pretty closely, which is quite striking. That tells us that if we look at the dark matter that came in, so the dark matter in our galaxy today that came in from the earliest mergers, they're actually tracked pretty well by the stars that came in from those same early mergers. So now we can evolve the movie forward in time. So we can ask, okay, now the disk has formed, but we still continue to have some smaller mergers. These mergers are not going to be perturbing the overall gravitational potential of the system quite as much, but they're still going to leave an imprint. So for example, you can imagine some small satellite galaxy that falls in. It's going to feel the tidal pull of our big galaxy here in the middle, and that tidal pull will start shredding that satellite galaxy. So in particular, it will start pulling off dark matter and stars from this satellite. The dark matter and stars that get pulled off essentially just kind of make a stream behind the path that the galaxy has taken as it falls in. So we can go in the simulation and actually identify these kinds of more recent mergers. And then look at, how the stars and the dark matter from those mergers behave. So here's an example, again, in velocity space, where we look at the behavior of the dark matter and the stars from a single galaxy that's merged into the simulated Milky Way. And the dark matter here is shown in blue, and the stars are in pink. And in this case, because the merger is a lot younger, you can see that the two track each other, but they don't track each other perfectly. And the reason for that is that the system has not had a chance. Like this material is not in equilibrium. And so the system has not had a chance to fully relax. And so we do see differences between the dark matter and the stars in these cases from the younger mergers. The last example is one where we look to see what happens to this satellite as it's made a few orbits around the host galaxy. So as it does this, it continues to leave material behind, and all of that material starts getting spatially mixed up, because you can think of this as kind of winding yarn around some ball, and you start losing any information about individual streams, but you get kind of a cloud of material that's left behind. The kind of structure, substructure that you get in this case is referred to as debris flow. It's not spatially, it's not very striking, but you retain information in velocity space. So again, we can identify these kinds of scenarios in the simulations. This is one example. So I'm going to show here, these are the stars and the dark matter from one of these older mergers in the simulations. This is just showing a subset that's kind of in this region close to the solar position in the simulations. This is at redshift zero. So there's no, you can see they're just kind of, everything is spread out. There's no spatial information there. And now I'm going to show you what happens as we wind the clock backwards in the simulation. And it'll show you where all of the dark matter and star particles there came from. So as the clock winds backward and you go to higher redshift, the material starts becoming more coherent. So here, around here is where you start seeing it look more stream-like. And then, so here, increasingly more coherent. And then once we hit redshift one or two, you actually see all of the stars and dark matter go back to the original clump, which is almost there. There it is. So that was essentially the original object that started falling in. It gets disrupted. It produces streams. All of that material gets mixed up. And then gets spatially smoothed out. But even when it's spatially smoothed out, if we look in velocity space at redshift zero, it has these kind of unique features in the radial velocity, and the dark matter and the star distributions actually trace each other pretty well in this case.
So if you plot instead of these coordinates, but instead of using action angle coordinates, do you see as much like smearing out?
What do you mean, smearing out here?
Yeah, for example, right.
So we haven't tried that. I think you'd see probably less smearing out. I think you'd probably preserve some of the initial conditions a bit better. Yeah.
Are there actually angle coordinates for a multi-particle system?
Also, do you know what the potential is as a function of time? Then you can work out at least actions, right?
But isn't this feeding back into the system?
Yeah, I mean, you do need to, you would need to know the potential as a function of time, is Neil's point, yeah.
Coarse grain the system, I guess, to get the potential, although I'm not sure if that's necessary. Yeah, but that would be the only exercise, so it's that.
Yeah, so there's pros and cons to using the action angle space. We had decided to stay in velocity space so that we could avoid the question about the potential. But if you do make some assumption about the potential, then you do, and you think it's a robust assumption about the potential, you could end up seeing better clustering in the particles. So the two main takeaways from this work on simulations are the following. The first is that the mergers that build up the Milky Way leave their imprint in a bunch of either spatial or velocity structures. So we can go out and look for features in the phase-space distribution of stars and then use that to infer something about the merger history of the galaxy. And then the last point here is that in certain instances, and especially in cases where the mergers are particularly old, the stars serve as visible tracers for the dark matter halo. And in that cases, you can use these stars to infer something about how certain components of the dark matter halo are built up. So that takes me to the second part of my talk, which is, given what we've learned from simulations, how can we now apply this to data from Gaia, where we're actually getting information about the phase-space information from stars? So the Gaia mission is the follow-up astrometric survey to Hipparchos, which ran in the early 1990s. It was launched in December 2013 and had its second full data release in April 2018. So what's the huge improvement that we're getting from Gaia is that it provides measurements for over a billion stars, which is about 1% of all of the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. This is a huge step from what we had before. So what this data allows us to do is essentially an archaeological study of our galaxy. So we can start off with a map of the Milky Way galaxy from Gaia. So these are all of the stars as observed by Gaia. And we can try to then pick out of these the ones that we believe would have come in from these mergers. This is akin to going fossil hunting, because most of the stars that you see in this map are not from the mergers. Most of them are stars that were born in the Milky Way. So in the same way that as an archaeologist goes out, finds a fossil, and then uses information about the shape of the fossil, the environment, or perhaps some radioactive dating to infer something about the creature that that fossil came from, this endeavor requires using information about the positions of the stars, their velocity, and their chemical properties to go from this picture to one like this, where we infer something about the history of the galaxy and the actual merger that those stars came from. So just quickly, I'll kind of lay out schematically how this is done. An important element that comes into play here is using the chemical information of the stars. So really just the amount of metal content of those stars. That metal content is correlated with age. So the more metal poor stars will tend to be older. And in addition, work by Kirby et al. And others have shown that the age of the stars is correlated with the mass of the system that those stars originated from. So for example, the oldest stars here will tend to come from the smallest galaxies that came in, versus the more metal-rich stars, the youngest ones, which are associated with much larger galaxies. So if you see a population of stars with a particular metal content, that tells you something about its age, and it also tells you something about the mass of the system that those stars originated in. So when we take something like data from Gaia, we have a multidimensional space in which we can look for clusters of stars. So looking both for features in spatial distribution, velocity distribution, and chemical abundance. So this is just a schematic illustrating how we can identify stars that might be associated from these mergers. So for example, on this left panel here, I'm showing the metal content, which again is correlated with age, with the oldest stars being down here and the youngest ones being up here. And this is the rotational velocity of the stars in the galaxy. So the stars that we would label as being accreted, or the ones that came from these mergers, would typically be older. So they kind of populate down here, and they don't actually have any net rotational velocity typically, because they're not born in the disk, and so they're not necessarily rotating with the disk. In contrast, any star that's born in the Milky Way will be more metal rich because it's much younger, and it'll be rotating. So when you look at the data in planes like this, you can separate out stars that are born in the disk versus those that were born outside of the galaxy. So the first part that I'm going to show you today is an analysis that focuses on this region of the sky, so that's boxed in here. In this first analysis, we're avoiding anything that's in the galactic plane. And the reason for that is the backgrounds essentially become huge in here. So we're going to start where things are simpler and look away from the galactic plane. For the motivation I gave you in the beginning was wanting to map the dark matter halo for any direct detection experiment. Obviously, for that kind of application, we do need to extend this down into the plane. And that's what I'll show you after I present these results. So very close after the second Gaia data release, two groups led by Vasily Belokurov and Amina Helmi presented results showing that a very large fraction of the stars in our corner of the galaxy likely came in from a single merger, so one big galaxy. And that galaxy, that whole process is shown here in the simulation, where the red are the stars from this merger. So what this result essentially...
Sorry, can you... this is based on Gaia data?
Yes.
So how can you tell that?
Actually, I'll show you in the next... couple slides. Yeah, so here's just the simulation again. So this is the the satellite. It's referred to as Enceladus. And this is all of the red stuff is all the material that it leaves behind.
So is the orbit in the plane of the disk?
It's on a highly radial orbit. And so most of the material that it's left behind is kind of concentrated fairly close to the disk, yes.
It's sort of like if it was an elliptical, it would be like a shell galaxy, where you get that kind of sloshing back and forth and leaves those fans. Is that sort of what's happening?
What's sloshing in the elliptical?
Well, the shell, you know, the shell galaxies, which have the shells where you go through the middle and then it has bits that are turning around and that makes those sort of cusps.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, what you're seeing here, this is old enough that the cusps and the shells have essentially blurred together. Yeah. So what this result essentially allows us to do is now to start reducing the possibilities for our family tree. And we were able to put a peg for one of our oldest relatives. So this merger Enceladus, which came from this galaxy that had a stellar mass of roughly 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, about 7 billion years ago. So it's believed that this one particular galaxy contributed a lot of stars in our corner of the Milky Way.
So did our star also come from that galaxy?
Probably not, because you mean our sun?
Yeah.
It's too metal rich. Yeah. So this is illustrating how you would actually see this in the data. So what I'm showing here are three panels where the vertical axis here is the chemical composition or metallicity of the stars. And then this is radial velocity, this is V theta and V phi. This kind of density here is just literally out of the box. You take the Gaia data, you cross match it with Sloan, and you put it down on this map. So if you've never looked at images like this before, this doesn't look particularly helpful. It looks like a bunch of blobs. But what we want to do is now separate this out using a clustering algorithm to find the stars that are most closely related to each other. So in particular, what we're going to do is ask the clustering algorithm to find the set of very metal poor stars that are related to each other, intermediate metallicity stars, and then the most metal rich ones. So the very metal poor ones will be associated with the dark matter that came in from the really old mergers. The intermediate metallicity stars will be the ones associated with the dark matter that came from Enceladus. And then the metal-rich stars are just the Milky Way disk stars. So when you run this clustering algorithm, you identify these three separate populations. And these curves that I'm showing are not just ones that we've sketched by hand. These are actually the posterior distributions of doing a full Bayesian analysis on this. So the green here are showing the Milky Way disk stars. And you can see that they have some rotational velocity of roughly 220 kilometers per second. The pink are the stars that came in from the oldest merger, so they're roughly isotropic. And then the blue are the stars that we believe are coming in from this Enceladus merger. And you can see that the blue is distinct from the disk stars and is highly radial here. So it's got a large radial dispersion, which is what's accounting for that behavior you saw on the movie, where the material is kind of really spread out and closely aligned with the disk.
Sorry, one question.
Yes.
Where do you separate these three groups? Is something you decide a priori, or it's the data that tell you where you have to do it?
So we've set up a full likelihood analysis where we are essentially asking for three separate Gaussian clusters. And the priors are fairly loose. We do require that one of the Gaussians is peaked pretty close to 220, because we expect that for the disk. But the priors for the other components, again, are allowed to vary over a fairly large range. And we give this one here, the substructure component, a bit more flexibility so it can capture this kind of sausage-like shape. And then we just run a full MCMC on this to recover what the best fit parameters are, and that's what's shown by these contours.
Are you checking simulations? you also check the same algorithm in simulations to check that the stars that you're capturing are the correct ones? Will you do that? Or this is just on data, right?
This is just on data.
But will you check it in simulations to
see? Yeah, so we've also have run similar kinds of clustering algorithms on the simulations. Ironically, it looks like the Milky Way is a much simpler system than the simulations we have to work with. In the sense that in the simulations, we see there's actually a lot of different mergers that end up giving contributions close to like where like the sun is in the simulation. Whereas in the Milky Way, it looks like it's kind of dividing up pretty cleanly into like only a few components. So in the simulations, it's actually a little bit harder to get this to work because there's a bunch more clusters. But that's something that we're still studying now to really understand the systematic uncertainties associated with this kind of clustering algorithm.
So originally, is that the way that Helmi and company found it, or is it a different way that?
So the original analyses by Helmi and Vasily were, Mina and Vasily, were not using this likelihood method. So we had done this because we actually were thinking about the applications for the dark matter, and we actually wanted to get a model for the velocities that came up.
How did they find it?
So they did a simpler kind of Gaussian fitting. So using what's called extreme, well, like Vasily's paper, for example, used extreme deconvolution. And so you can, you know, and also they're amazing, like they can find structures and everything. So like even when, you know, they both have like amazing sets of eyes for these kinds of things. So, yeah.
So the algorithm has or they have?
Yeah.
But then your results are consistent.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so our results like actually put a likelihood to it and can recover separate components and are consistent with what they're finding.
When you say it mostly comes from one merger, you mean when you try to add a fourth Gaussian, there's no...
That's right, yeah. One thing that we can't rule out is if there happened to be a bunch of mergers that all ended up leaving the same imprint like this, kind of all the same mass and kind of all roughly came in at the same time. We can't rule that out. Yeah, and it's an open question whether or not Enceladus is actually one thing or more than one thing.
So is Sagittarius here on here?
So Sagittarius would not dominate in this region that we're looking in.
It's still on its, still early in its.
Yeah, and Sagittarius would also very much look like a stream. So you can actually make out the stream. Yeah. So just putting this all together, when we do the full analysis, we can actually break down the composition of all of the nearby stars and say about 40% of them came in from really old mergers, and about 60% came in from this Enceladus merger, so our nearest relative. Given the work we've been doing on simulations, assuming that our halo is cold dark matter, we can go from this mapping here to an assumption about what the dark matter composition is. From simulations, we know that the old stars map really well onto the old dark matter, and that material in these kinds of debris flow structures also map really well onto the dark matter. So that allows us to kind of infer what the dark matter components would look like. And you might notice that the fractions here have swapped. That's not a typo. There's actually a lot of work that needs to go into figuring out how to go from stellar fractions to dark matter fractions, and that would take me a bit off course, though I'm happy to discuss it afterwards. But in the dark matter case, we assume that about 60% is coming from this old component and 40% from Enceladus. So this is already pushing on the standard halo model that we have for our galaxy. We've gone from this simple picture to one where we now believe that there's at least two components comprising the local dark matter halo, where the second component is coming from this new relative that's been discovered using the Gaia data. Now, as I said in the beginning, everything I've showed you up until this point is focusing on these regions here that are outside of the galactic plane. And what we want to do now is extend into the galactic plane, because that's what's going to be most relevant for direct detection experiments. The challenge in doing this is that when we go in the galactic plane, the backgrounds become enormous. So only about 1% of the stars in this region are accreted.
Sorry, question. You said you're outside the galactic plane by how much? I guess.
Oh, about 2.5 kiloparsecs.
Okay.
Plus or minus.
And how many stars did you have in that region?
Well, the cross match with Sloan, because we were using the metallicity information, gave us about a few hundred thousand total. The number of stars increases when you go into the galactic plane, but the vast majority of them are stars that were actually just born in the Milky Way, and only 1% of them are essentially interesting for our purposes. So this whole exercise becomes that much more challenging because you need to find a needle in a haystack here to separate out these disk stars from the stars that you think would come from these mergers. So this is where we've put machine learning to use, to see if whether or not the machine can actually do a better job at distinguishing these two populations of stars than any human could do by eye. And this is work that was led by Lena and Brian Ostiak at University of Oregon. So when you're working with deep neural networks, you train them on a set of labeled photos. So in this case, we have cats and dogs. If you give it lots of pictures of cats, and you know, train the system on that so that it learns what a picture of a cat is, such that when you actually give it some random picture that you have and pass it through your neural net, the system can then hypothesize whether or not that initial image was a cat or a dog. And in this case, it comes out and it says it's a dog. So what we want to do is essentially use the same thing, except instead of training the neural net on cats and dogs, we want to train it on stars that were born in the galaxy versus stars that were born outside of the galaxy in mergers. So to do that, we need a set of photos, essentially, to train the system on. And in that place, we're very lucky because of the work from Phil's group and other groups that are creating mock catalogs of stars in Milky Way-like galaxies based on simulations. So I'm showing here two images. One is actual Gaia data of our Milky Way, and the other one is a simulated galaxy. They're a little saturated, I think, because of the light. So it, but you know, so maybe this is a little bit easier to guess given the saturation. But the question is, which one is the actual simulation and which one is the data? And turns out this is the data, and this is the simulation. It's actually quite remarkable how quickly the advancements on the simulation side have occurred over the last 5 years. You know, maybe about a decade ago, a lot of these kinds of simulations couldn't reproduce staple disks in Milky Way type galaxies, and now we're getting disks with features that are actually quite similar to the features that we see in the Milky Way. Now, there's obviously differences, and you can see that by eye in terms of like the gas distribution and the amount of extinction, and the masses aren't exactly the same. And I'm not saying that we're like getting this exactly, but it's a really big improvement over where we were at. So the question is whether or not we can train the network on the simulations and then use that to infer something about the actual data.
Could I ask a question? So when you compare like data and simulations, so do you have to have a model for how the detector collects the, say, luminal data and translates it into an image? Or, so in the simulation, you could represent the different intensities by just some local energy density, some temperature, or something like that. Whereas mm-hmm. in the actual measurement, you have to detect something and translate it into something.
Yeah, so what we're using for this training is actually a mock catalog that's been built based off of the simulation. So as we were discussing before, the simulations have like big star clusters and big dark matter particles and things like that. To create these mock catalogs, what they do is actually take a star cluster and distribute it into individual stars and actually assign to it properties that are exactly what you measure if Gaia was... If you had put a Gaia satellite in your simulation...
So you sort of bootstrap the simulation to have data-like properties.
Exactly, yeah. So they put like a fake Gaia in the simulation and then create a mock catalog of what that fake Gaia would observe.
Library, just
yeah.
pieces on it.
Yeah, exactly. So this picture up here is actually from this mock catalog and not from the original simulation. I'll say that when we first got started on this like over 2 years ago, I didn't think it was going to work. And there's lots of reasons why this should fail. So we did a lot of steps to kind of check this. So for example, we can start with one galaxy that's simulated. We can train the network on one location in that galaxy and then test the network on the same location. When we do that, everything works and the network actually recovers properties of the stars that are very close to truth.
Sorry, what do you mean by training? What do you train it to do?
Yeah, so we give the, good question, yeah. So we give the network the 5D kinematics of the stars, so everything except the radial velocity, and then we ask it to infer the full 60 informations of those stars. So we want, and then we, it's simulation, so we know the true 60, and so we can test to see whether or not it's correctly inferred from the 5D inputs, the actual 60 information. So there's some super complicated coordinate transformation that's occurred to get this, like no human can write it down, but the question is whether or not the computer can actually learn this. And so when we compare the inferred 60 information to the true 60 information, it works quite well in this case. Now, the obvious concern is, well, okay, you know, you're training the system on a particular region of the galaxy where you know, what happens if some other, what happens if the network is learning something very specific about that corner of the galaxy you've trained it on? So we can repeat this process where we train the network on stars here with 5D information, and then we apply it to stars in a different part of the galaxy. And again, in this case, we find that the network does a really good job at predicting the full 60 information for the stars. 5 minutes? Okay.
Are you always training and testing on the same simulation?
Good. Is the network learning something specific about this particular galaxy? And this was actually the point where I thought the whole thing was going to fail. Fortunately, the FIRE team has a host of these galaxies, so what we can do...
So we're using the FIRE simulations, like not testing on like other teams?
Yeah, not yet. I mean, that's actually, that would be a great thing to try this out on. Yeah, so what we did then was train on one particular Milky Way galaxy that the FIRE has and test it on a completely different galaxy. The reason I thought this was totally going to fail in this step was because these two galaxies have extremely different merger histories. So they're very, very different, even though they're both like Milky Way sized. So I was convinced that the network was probably learning something specific about this individual galaxy. But when we did this, it actually worked again. And one additional layer we had to add in was this transfer training, which allows you to retrain the last layer of the network on the new galaxy. And with that additional technique, we actually did a very good job at reproducing the properties of that new galaxy.
But if you don't do that, I mean, what happens?
It's still not bad, but it's not quite as good. Yeah. So.
Is there any quantitative way you can phrase this?
Yes. I don't have the numbers here, but they're all in our paper. So we quantify it based off of the AUC index. So we have, you can see the kinds of gains that you get by adding the transfer training versus not having the transfer training. And then we tried all sorts of things like retraining last layer or the first layer. We had all different combos. And so we found that there was some gain to doing this particular configuration. And let's see, I'm running low on time, so I'm gonna skip this, but this is essentially the validation plot. Well, maybe I shouldn't skip this since it's the validation plot. Okay, I'll just go fast on the remaining slides. But so this is just showing that each of these panels here are the individual spatial coordinates, velocity coordinates. This is different chemical compositions of the stars and their age. The blue distributions in each of these panels show the distributions of the stars that the network was trained on. Then we apply the network to a different galaxy. That different galaxy has distributions that are shown in orange. Those are the true distributions. What the network infers on that new galaxy is shown by the dotted black. So if everything is working as you'd like it to work, the dotted black should actually be tracing the orange. What you don't want to happen is the network to have learned something about the original galaxy it was trained on. In that case, the dotted black line would have been following the blue, which is the original galaxy it was traced on. And you can see in each of these panels, the orange and the dotted black are in fairly good agreement, even in cases where the blue is quite different. The one panel where things are a little bit off and we don't totally understand why is the case with the age of the stars. Okay, so I'm going to go through the rest pretty quickly since I'm running out of time. But after doing these extensive tests on the simulations, we felt confident enough to start applying this to the Milky Way. So what we do in this case is we train the network on stars in one of the fire simulations, and then do transfer training on the Milky Way, and then study the network output there. So what we get from this exercise is a catalog of accreted stars in the Milky Way galaxy, and then we can analyze this and see what we recover. What's nice is we essentially find all the same structures that people have found using different methods, so that helps us believe that the network is outputting something that's valid. But in addition, we find some new things, and this is where the goddess of the night comes into play. So here, each of these panels is different velocity distributions, and the network output, so all of the stars that we get, are shown by the density plot. Enceladus is this blue contour here. So we can confirm that the stars from Enceladus go into the disk. So we know that that structure is actually there even close to the solar position. But in addition to Enceladus, we now see this new green blob here, here, and there, which we've called Nix, after the goddess of the night. And the question is, what is this blob?
Sorry, before you go on, yeah. How is this different from the previous plot you showed us? I guess that had metallicity in it.
Yeah, so you mean the one earlier? The one earlier had metallicity
right.
on this axis. We actually, for this training, have not used any metallicity information. So the only thing that I'm showing are just the velocity coordinates here.
And in terms of, I mean, how far from a disk you get here?
Oh, yeah. So actually, everything I'm showing you here is within like a few kiloparsec of the sun. So now we're like deep within the disk plane. So this was something we could totally not do before.
And you haven't used metallicity because you didn't trust your network for that?
No, we didn't use metallicity because it would reduce the sample size that we had to work with. Although one of the things that's definitely on our to-do list is to also add in metallicity and see how it changes things. Yeah, so this is actually essentially the first time that we could really look for these kinds of substructures, like deep within the galactic plane and really close to the solar position. So the question is, what's this new structure here that we're calling Nix? Since I'm probably almost certainly out of time, I'll just very quickly say that the features of this blob are really intriguing. In particular, we identify about 500 stars in this structure, and all of them have coherent velocities, and they're all very close to the disk plane. So here's Z, so vertical position off the plane, and X, here's the sun. And each little arrow here is a star that's in this cluster. And so you can see they're all close to the sun, and they're all moving kind of in this direction. The Nix stars are rotating slowly with the disk, but they're on much more eccentric orbits than any regular disk star. It doesn't really, because the eccentricity is really quite different from a regular disk star, it sort of smells like it's something unique. That being said, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done to really identify and pinpoint exactly what the origin of these stars are. There's a couple possibilities. So one is that it's actually just a perturbation of the Milky Way disk stars. So maybe from the bar or the spiral arms. These explanations, based off of simulations that have already been done, do not quite get the right eccentricity. They don't quite predict the same radial velocities that we're seeing here. So that's why it doesn't quite seem to fit. Results that do seem to fit better from previous works are that this is a stream from tidal debris of a really massive dwarf galaxy that was actually disrupted in the Milky Way disk. So there's work by Justin Reed and Manoj from almost a decade ago looking at simulations of these really massive galaxies that get disrupted in the Milky Way disk. And a lot of the features of what they see and predict there are very similar to what we're seeing with Nix. What's particularly intriguing is that in these kinds of systems, what gets left behind is a rotating disk of dark matter. So if we can confirm that this is what the Nix origin, what Nix's origin is, the implication would be that actually you have this rotating dark matter component with the disk, kind of a fluffy dark matter disk. And we would be moving then quite dramatically from a picture of the sort of spherical dark matter halo to one where you have a spherical dark matter halo and also this kind of fluffy rotating dark matter disk that's also there. But in order to really nail this, as I said, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. And in particular, further spectroscopic observations of these stars are going to be really important for distinguishing these two potential origins. So now I will really conclude, so I don't get kicked off. Our goal was to characterize the local dark matter. Our philosophy in doing this is to be taking a fully empirical approach and to do this bottom up. So we want to essentially build it up component by component. So the way I usually think about it is you get dark matter that's going to have come from these luminous, bright satellite galaxies. And then you also have dark matter that would have come from non-luminous satellite galaxies. Everything I've told you about today is dark matter that comes from galaxies that have stars in them. So all of the work we've done in simulations pertains to this particular branch here. And from what we've studied, we now think that this dark matter can be divided into at least two components for sure, and now we're still trying to figure out this Nix piece there. So we might have a two or three component dark matter, at least two or three components of the dark matter from this branch of the diagram. What we yet have still to understand is how much of the local dark matter would come from satellite galaxies that don't have any stars in them. Because all of the methods and techniques I've told you about would not be sensitive to this particular element. And so we have a lot of work in progress, both trying to characterize this piece here, which has the question mark, and then also trying to figure out if we can make some inroads on this piece there. And so then taken together, then we hope to kind of build this up to have the total dark matter distribution. I think we have a plan for how to get there and sort of have started the steps in that direction. So with that, I'll conclude and happy to take any additional questions.
I just want to repeat a question that I think Mark Houghton asked about this Sagittarius which is, I mean, I guess we had evidence for it before, so how come we don't see it now? I mean, I guess that should be better than
So Sagittarius isn't believed to have passed very close to where the sun is. So we're looking very close to the solar position here.
Like how close, you said?
Just a few kiloparsec.
You see Sagittarius is farther than that?
It's on the opposite side.
But the stream
is not, like, people have done simulations and it's not believed to come that close to the solar position. The other thing too is that if it did come close to the solar position, most of those stars would have a very large VZ component, and we don't see it. We would have picked it up. Oh, this isn't in spherical and cylindrical, but we would have seen it as sort of a large VZ. So the fact we don't, it sort of just confirms what people are seeing from the simulations. Yeah,
that's a big VR, right? Like that's going out from the galactic?
Yeah, so that's what's really confusing. So most of these simulations where you get interesting features from perturbations to the disk find VRs that are like plus or minus 10 or 20 kilometers per second. But what we're finding for Nix is closer to like 150, 180 kilometers a second.
So for both of these, you know, new detected systems like Nix and Enceladus, for both of them, you find that the orbits are in the plane of our disk. So is that surprising? I mean, so for objects that are accreted, do you normally expect them to be dragged into the plane of the disk?
So for, like, in the work that this early work by Justin Reed and company, if the system is really massive, it actually is quite natural for this to happen, but it needs to be a really large galaxy.
So when you use Amplification, you're saying to drag it into the plane?
Yeah, so when it's really large and if it's coming in on this kind of like prograde orbit, it feels a large amount of dynamical friction with the disk and it just gets dragged in.
Right, that requires like quite a large mass.
Yeah, so they find masses between, like, it has to be larger than like 10 to the 10-ish. So it would have to be a fairly large system. Manoj had a paper, this Purcell et al. Paper here, where they actually looked to see how consistent these large mergers would be with like observed kinematics for the disk stars. And depending on the sort of angle at which the satellite's coming in and its mass, there's ranges where it still is consistent. So if it's coming in at like 60 degrees, and is like 10 to the 10, that's still consistent with the vertical dynamics of the disk, according to the simulations that they've looked at. Now, because these systems would have to be quite large, right, then that would tell you that the stars that it nicks would have to, you know, be quite metal-rich. There's very few of these stars where we have data from like apogee or something like that with the chemical abundances, but the few that we do have suggest that they are pretty metal rich. So this is where these additional spectroscopic observations are going to be really key to kind of distinguishing what's going on.
All right, so since we're running a little bit past, why don't we thank Mariangela again.